JC2S, Part 1.
Number 2B.
So, what does this mean to be born of the water? See, Jesus gives us a really a logical birth here. He says, be born first of the water. Well, we know that means now, don't we, that that means the elements of mind. So he's saying that all reasoning must come from mind. That mind is the creator, the origin, the cause, the parent mind, the first, the basis of our reasoning. And we know then that mind only manifests itself as ideas. Those ideas are the true elements of the universe, as we will see. After we're born of the water, he says we must be born of the spirit. We must keep these elements of mind pure. We must always reason from mind. That's the Noah story, huh? That's the story of the second thousand years period, the story of spirit. To go into our arc of consciousness, to separate ourselves from the flood of duality, from the flood of material reasoning, and to center and focus ourselves on mind, on the source, on the origin. And to keep that vision pure. Not to let the sons of God marry the daughters of men so that there'll be giants in the earth. That's always tempting, isn't it? To let the sons of God, what we're seeing in the science of God, marry the isms and ology of the world. Why? So that we'd be giants on the earth. Big shots on the earth. Accepted on the earth. But Jesus always said about his science that he did not walk in the earth or with the earth. He walked over the earth. He was outside and above the earthly reasoning. So we must keep then this vision of mind pure at the point of spirit, and to see that that mind, that reasoning from mind, is the only substance of our vision, the only standpoint of our vision. And then he says, then we can enter into the kingdom of God. Then we can see the land of our true identity. Then we can enter then that standpoint of soul. Now, this is, again, I just want to show many ways how this is brought out in the textbook to maintain this correct reasoning. Now, we began to see last evening that whole question posed in 1880 by Dubois-Raymond. You know, that natural scientist who then in his book, Die Sieben Welträtsel, translated into the seven enigmas or the seven riddles of the world, that here they're asking these questions, always remaining enigma to the reasoning from sense testimony. These questions, we'll see, can only be answered from the science of God. Otherwise, they just will continue, as we see, to remain an enigma until the Christ in its translation and retranslation adjusts the situation. So, therefore, the other way, just cover up all the way, that's it. Now, therefore, when we place on top of it now that prism of God, just so there's no light either on either side, that's it. Now, on top of it, we'll put now the prism. And we'll see then that in, as Mrs. Eddy said, as we saw last evening, and it's just an overlay which we can just use as a example, then that Mrs. Eddy in 1888, 100 years ago in her class, she said, upon these truths for God rest the science. In fact, they are the science. It's only from reasoning out from these seven synonymous terms for God which shook the universe, which revolutionize science, theology, and medicine. It's only out from the standpoint of reasoning from this science of God, from these capitalized terms, can we arrive at answering these riddles, answering these enigmas that are still being posed today in philosophy and science. Now, these are answered predominantly in the principal tone of this chapter, but I thought it would be good if we could take a look at that principal tone, because it is a powerhouse. It is really the standpoint of which the main tone of mind in this chapter, and then the main tone of spirit, and then the main tone of soul are building. It was interesting when I was working with this chapter this year, it was very easy to get the main tone of mind, relatively speaking, and then getting the main tone of spirit, and then the main tone of soul. But when I came to that main tone of principle, it was something else. It was as if I couldn't enter into the kingdom. As Mrs. Eddy would say, as you know, comest thou not into the secret? One couldn't get a hold of it. It was as if it was this great big, huge, vast, infinite realm of principle God and the science of God. Really, the epitome there being the ever-operative divine principle replaces the concept of a material science with the science of God. Anyone just could hardly get a hold of it. Till I realized that this whole principle tone cannot be grasped in the same step-by-step logical buildup of addition as one has through the main tone of mind or the main tone of spirit or the main tone of soul. But that whole principle tone must be approached only through that holistic, dimensional, structural, teleological logic of God. It can only be approached from holism, where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and then through the method of science, seeing somehow how that whole adapts itself in many different forms, dimensionally, yet still remains the whole. Tremendous, big, big tone. Now in this tone, just to take a glance at it, of the main tone of principle, she then answers these questions from principle as mind, from the categories of God, reasoning from God. And to this question, what is the origin of movement? Under the principle of mind tone, she says, adhesion, cohesion, and attraction are properties of mind. They belong to the divine principle and support that equipoise of that thought force which launched the earth into its orbit and said to the proud wave, thus far and no farther. We tread on forces, withdraw them, and creation must collapse. Human knowledge calls them forces of matter. But divine science declares that they belong wholly to the divine mind and are inherent in that mind, and so restores them to their rightful home and classification. So you see, she's showing that the origin of all movement is in the divine mind. In fact, at this tone of principle, mind shows that that mind is the origin of what we call the Big Bang. That mind, that action, or let's say, that mind, that power, that action, that thought force which launched the earth into its orbit. We know she says this statement, which we have looked at before, a student had taken down, where Mrs. Eddy says, the reason for asking, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? Is that Christian science must answer that question to the world, or all will be destroyed by fire in the year 2000. We know, and we talked about last evening, how 100 years to the day that she, in June 13, 1888, showed that science is revolutionary in its very nature, that it, what she gave us was a science that governs changes, that we know that right there at that time in 1888, that she then shows us that it's on the basis of the divine mind that the answers to these questions can be found. So we see then that on June 13, 1888, she gives us that science or the basis of answering the question, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? And we know then 100 years to the date on June 13, 1988, we have coming out in our magazines as if Time Magazine and in the Christian Science Monitor, this whole question of the origin of movement. Both sources talking about the origin of movement being explained from that standpoint of atomic force. How the physical scientists today are explaining it from the basis of matter in action. Here she shows in this chapter that that is not the basis from which to realize the origin of the universe, including man. She shows here that the basis then is to see that that origin of the universe is from the divine mind. That is the only way they're going to solve the question of what happened at the time of the Big Bang and what happened before the Big Bang is only from the science of God. Only from the standpoint that adhesion, cohesion, and attraction, those law of gravity, are properties of mind. And that they belong to the equipoise of that thought force which launched the Earth into its orbit. That is going to answer the question, is the universe, including man, evolved by atomic force? It says no. The universe, including man, is evolved by mind force, the divine mind force. Other places in the textbook and in her prose work, she shows tremendous statements for backing up what she shows in the sixth chapter. She says, withdraw God principle from man in the universe, and man in the universe would no longer exist. But annihilate matter, and man in the universe would remain a forever fact. In miscellany, she says that, 226. Or in miscellaneous writings, 23, she says, reason and revelation declare that God is both noumenon and phenomenon, cause, the first and only cause. That the universe, including man, is not a result of atomic action, material force or energy. It is not organized dust. And then, in the textbook 143, mind is the grand creator, and there can be no power except that which is derived from mind. If mind was first chronologically and is first potentially and must be first eternally, then give to mind the glory, honor, dominion, and power everlastingly due its holy name. And this one in miscellaneous writings is nice. She says, all is mind and its manifestation. From the rolling of worlds in the most subtle ether to a potato patch. And then quite shockingly, I think she says in miscellaneous writing, atomic action is mind, not matter. You see, she asks, is the universe evolved by atomic force? She says in one point that it is mind is the force, not the result of atomic action. And then by taking that basis of reasoning correctly from the divine mind as the thought force which launched the Earth into its orbit, she can very logically from that standpoint say, all action, even what we call atomic action, is mind. Not matter. Why? Because in reality, it is neither the energy of matter, the result of organization, nor the outcome of life infused into matter. It is infinite spirit truth life, defiant of air or matter. Therefore, we have seen in our study of the synonymous term that matter is just spirit misunderstood. That by seeing that all action, in this chapter she will show that all action, all cause and effect proceed from mind. All. Quite revolutionary. Then she goes on to answer this question, what is the nature of matter and energy under the principle of spirit tone in this chapter? And she says, thus matter will finally be proved nothing more than a mortal belief, wholly inadequate to affect a man through its supposed organic action or supposed existence. And then in this same chapter, at the mind of spirit tone, she gives what is the nature of the universe. She says, the three great verities of spirit, omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience, spirit possessing all power, filling all space, constituting all science, contradict forever the belief that matter can be actual. These eternal verities reveal primeval existence as the radiant reality of God's creation, in which all that he has made is pronounced by his wisdom good. Isn't that beautiful? Instead of a matter universe, we have the radiant reality, the pure reflection of mind, called the substance of spirit. Then, in answer to the question, how do sensations or the perceptive faculties arrive? She shows in this principle of soul tone, not answering this question from the standpoint of the physical senses of which this question asks, but answers how do perceptive faculties arise in the same way, really, as Jesus showed us, that if a man be born of the water and of the spirit, then he can see the kingdom of God. That if we're born of mind and go out from the one mind which is God, and we see the universe as mind sees the universe, and at the point of spirit, stick to that vision of mind, keep that vision pure, then we see the land of our true identity. Then we perceive reality, that perceptions arrive on the basis of what we have already seen, of going out from principle as mind, principle of spirit, sticking to that standpoint. We then, from that standpoint of spiritual understanding, we perceive the realm of reality. She even will show that even that this has its impact, that this science of soul, this principle of soul sense, spiritual understanding, has its impact even on the limitations of the human perceptions. And she says here that the impact of spiritual understanding on human perception is that it gives access to broader and higher realms of insight and perception. That it even will, she says, enhance the perceptions even to the point where they will rise higher above themselves out of limitation. She says, freeing the human mind from its limitations and giving it access to broader and higher realms of insight and perception. Then to answer the fourth question, and the principle of principle tone, what is the background of free will? She shows here, as she does in other parts of the textbook, that principle is imperative. It cannot be mocked by human will or what we call free will. And at this point of principle and principle, she shows that that principle, that science of God, rests on a fixed principle. And she says, and it cannot be influenced by the judgment of false sensation or the judgment of our personal preconceptions. Then in the fifth point, how does life originate? The principle of life tone in this chapter is really a big one, and we'll see when we get there, that she answers it according to how does life originate. Really, she answers here the question of what occurred before the Big Bang. And she shows that life originates in spiritual reality from the science of divine ontology, from the science of that fixed principle, which is based on those ontological categories of being. She shows then that from that science of divine ontology, from those ontological categories of being, which we now know as the nature of God, its essence and wholeness as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, in its operation as the word Christ, Christianity, and science, on the levels of science itself, divine science, absolute Christian science, and Christian science. From these ontological categories, from this fixed principle, which is always restructuring itself, from this womb, from this matrix of immortality, springs life. From this womb, from these categories, which are constantly restructuring themselves according to the infinite logic of events, comes every new category of life, comes every new life event. So she shows here at this principle of life tone that from that principle, from those fixed categories, comes life. From that fixed principle, which is constantly restructuring itself, constantly springs forth the newness of life, which never repeats itself, which is always infinite. Infinite not in time and space, but infinite insofar as it spirals higher and higher from a boundless basis. And then, in answer to the question, what is conscious thinking and language, at this tone of principle truth, she shows quite clearly that conscious thinking is really principle conscious of itself. And at this tone, she shows conscious thinking as principle conscious of itself as the actuality of science, as the truth of science. And she shows then that conscious thinking then is principle conscious of itself as the actuality of the structural language of science, destroying all error in science. And then in answer to this question, what is the purpose of nature? She shows under that tone, principle is love, that the purpose of nature is that that principle which is love is expressed. That principle, God, operates as a goal causality, wholeness causality, oneness causality principle. That principle, God, is love. It's operating to bring out its goal, principle's goal, not our goal. That it's operating to bring out principle's wholeness, to show that principle is always operating holistically, always is principle, always is a whole. Yes, infinitely individualized, dimensionally, adapted to a specific situation, yet always still remaining the whole. So principle operates as love, always to show that everything in the universe going on is principle, operating holistically, as wholeness causality. And she shows that the purpose of the universe is that principle is operating as love, as oneness causality. On every single level of consciousness, she brings out, therefore, that sense of oneness, of the oneness of, on the science level, of principle, the infinite one, on the oneness of divine science, where principle and its universal idea is one, and this one is principle. And then on the level of absolute Christian science, which shows that principle and its infinite individualities, its infinite ideas, is just really the way principle appears in many different ways, yet still remains principle. And then on the level of Christian science, through that the equipollence of God, through the logic of that level, shows then that only principle is God is real, only the universe of principle God is real, only the infinite individuality and infinite individualities of principle God is real, and that this awful unreality called evil is unreal. So we see then that this chapter will answer then these questions posed by physical science, these enigmas. And I think that the big point she brings out in her whole textbook, that if we do reason then from false reasoning, from material logic, that these questions will continue to be enigma. It will only be, as we'll see in this chapter, because of the Christ, because of that translation going on, the law of translation and reformation, or we could say the law of translation and retranslation, which is having its impact, we know, on world consciousness, bringing it from a physical explanation of science into a much more mental explanation of science, finally into spiritual science, will then this material reasoning yield? And when that material reasoning yields from incorrect reasoning, from dualism, into the correct one-value logic of spirit, it will remain an enigma, these questions, until the science of God, through the law of translation and retranslation, sets the sciences on its original basis, which is on a spiritual basis, which is on reasoning from mind to idea, which is really based then on that one-valued logic of spirit.